So when was the last time you walked into a record store? If it was recently, you are the exception. People spending money and buying music in physical form, either on CD or on vinyl, which just never seems to die, those are a minority these days. And why not? You can buy a song or album in digital form and have it in your device almost instantly. The change from the old record store model to what we have today is outlined in a book called How Music Got Free: The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. It's written by Stephen Witt, who earned a math degree and then played the market for several years, working for hedge funds in Chicago and New York. He then spent a couple of years working in economic development in Africa, returning home for a journalism degree from Columbia. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker and other publications. Stephen Witt, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
The topic is so big and covered so much. I mean, how big a task was this for you to take on?
Well, you know, I really tried to find an original way to approach this subject. It had a lot of personal meaning for me because I'd sort of come of age in the generation that had pirated all these music files. And looking over this sort of massive archive I'd assembled of over 100,000 MP3s in 2007, all of which I obtained legally, I began to wonder, you know, how did all of this really happen? And as I investigated it, I sort of expected to find kind of a crowdsource phenomenon with scattered uploaders around the globe, you know, ripping off music piecemeal and posting it online. That assumption turned out to be almost completely false. The vast majority of music on the Internet can be traced back to just a few people, and in particular, one dedicated music-leaking group called Rapid Neurosis that over the course of 10 years infiltrated the music industry supply chain and leaked out something like 25,000 albums.
Well, that explains the term patient zero. So you actually did find an individual where a lot of this started.
That's right. So Rapid Neurosis had sources all over the planet. They had guys in Japan who would sort of arbitrage offset international release dates. They had music journalists in the UK with access to advanced copies of albums. They had radio DJs and music promoters and all sorts of people you would sort of expect to have access to early pre-release music. But the one guy who really made the group work was a factory worker at a compact disc manufacturing facility in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. He worked the packaging line.
That's Del Glover we're talking about.
That was Del Glover. His name was Del Glover. He worked the packaging line, and the hottest hits of the year were literally at his fingertips weeks and sometimes months before anybody else could get them. He devised a scheme to smuggle these albums out of the plant. He ripped them to MP3 on his home computer, uploaded them to this conspiracy, and quickly they were available on peer-to-peer networks and iPods around the globe within probably 24 hours or less. So if you ever pirated music in the 2000s, or even just had some music on your hard drive, and you weren't exactly sure where it came from, it probably came from RNS, and most likely it passed through Del Glover's hands. And so for this reason, he's the patient zero of music piracy. Very few people have sort of been untouched by what he did.
So you mentioned having a lot of music yourself digital. Was some of it illegal back in your college years?
Oh, it was all illegal, sure. And we didn't think of it that way at the time, though. You know, what had happened is the development of the MP3 encoder, which is something I go into a lot in the book as well, it had been built in Germany over the course of 10 years, directed by a guy named Karl-Heinz Brandenburg, who was sort of a brilliant German audio engineer. But he found himself locked out of the market. He really had sort of the Betamax of audio. And in desperation in 19...
In other words, a high-quality thing, but just not one that was accepted by consumers.
That's exactly right. He had the best leading technology on the market, but he couldn't get any industrial customers. And he couldn't get the recording industry to listen to him either. So in desperation in 1995, he posted a shareware encoder of this MP3 technology on the web. Quickly, the pirates cracked it and started using it to make illegal music files. I showed up at college for the first time a couple years later, and, you know, for the first time in my life, I really had access to sort of broadband cable and faster internet than the, you know, very slow telephone modems I'd been using up to that point. That gave me the capacity to download MP3s. I showed up with maybe a 20-pound box with 2 gigabytes of storage space. That's about the equivalent of 1/16th of your cell phone today. By the end of my first semester at school, I this thing was full of pirated music files, and that continued for the next 10 years. By the end, almost out of compulsive habit.
Well, yeah, you point out that some of the stuff that you downloaded was not even really stuff you cared for. You talk about ABBA to ZZ Top, and it doesn't sound like you really much cared for either ABBA or ZZ Top.
No, I I like ZZ Top. I mean, I can listen to Sharp Dressed Man or Eliminator a few times in a row. But for, you know, ABBA, I actually hate. You know, a lot of this hoarding behavior was really compulsive. This used to happen in the days of vinyl, too. You'd get these guys who would just build these enormous collections of vinyl records. They wouldn't even listen to most of them. They didn't have a reason to have all of them. And I think for a lot of digital people, there was digital hoarding as well. You know, filling up your hard drive with you know, years worth of material that you would never listen to, that you couldn't even have time to listen to, but you did it anyway.
In defense of the vinyl guys, sometimes if you had the Fabulous Poodles, Mirror Stars in college, you really had to have it as an adult, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, look, I feel the same way. I mean, I listened to Nirvana growing up, and then my CD got scratched. I got to go get it again, right?
No doubt. So, was it a process of feeling some guilt about the downloads that turned you onto the story in the first place?
No, it was fascination, to be honest with you. Guilt didn't come until much later. I don't know if I ever really felt guilt exactly. You have to understand this was a generational shift in the way that people thought about media and digital material. I compare it in the book to the sort of similar generational shift that had happened in the 60s regarding the experimentation with illegal drugs. For a lot of us, piracy felt like kind of a victimless crime. Now, maybe that wasn't true, but it felt that way at the time, and I think that motivated a lot of our behavior. Plus, it was a far superior solution to what the recording industry was legally offering, which was very expensive and cumbersome.
Well, you know, and I remember certainly in one of my college years, people would like get their new albums and put them directly onto cassette, which of course was not considered cool either by the recording industry. But we'll get into the further details of legality, illegality, piracy, theft, and all the other great things that have conspired to turn the music industry into something it really didn't intend to be. The book is called How Music Got Free. Stephen Witt wrote it, and he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Stephen and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. You probably have a few pirating experiences yourself. Join us on the Exchange when we come back from this break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the music industry and the gigantic transformation it's undergone in recent years. Gone from the record store model where we walked in and bought albums, and now it's gone to something where we download things and don't always pay for them. It's all documented in a book called How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. Stephen Witt wrote it, and he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So one of the first people we meet in the book is, in fact, Karlheinz Brandenburg, as you pointed out, the guy who developed the MP3 encoder and the MP3 format in the first place. What else was he working on? I mean, how did he begin working in this direction?
It's such a fascinating story. In 1982, Brandenburg's thesis advisor, a guy named Dieter Seitzer, had this idea for a new kind of service. This was the same year, by the way, that the compact disc debuted. But he kind of saw the compact disc as an inefficient method of distribution. He had this other idea. Why don't we have people call up on their telephone lines to a centralized computer server? They'll select via the touchpad the music that they want to hear through some code, and then we'll stream it back to them over the telephone line, which will be connected to the stereo. Okay?
A digital jukebox in 1982, he thought.
In 1982, he was proposing this. Okay, so something almost exactly what we have like Spotify today, but 33 years ago. Tried to apply for a patent on such a device, and the patent was rejected. The patent examiner said to Seitzer, sure, it's a great idea, but this telephone line, it's way too narrow. You're never going to be able to fit all this massive amount of data on a compact disc down this little pipe. You got to tell me a way that you're going to shrink it. So Seitzer deputized his graduate student, Karlheinz Brandenburg, to figure out this problem. Brandenburg was a genius. He really is. He's very tall. He's awkward. He's sort of erratic body language, but he's very brilliant. And he figured out this method that took advantage of natural, inherited flaws that we have in our auditory systems as human beings that we've sort of been given by natural selection. and he exploited these little flaws to hide much of the data and to bury or mute many of the frequencies on the compact disc with almost no noticeable loss in audio quality.
So the imperfections in our ears, then, he figured out a way to sort of work in tandem with those.
That's right. This whole method is called psychoacoustic compression. And so he was sort of the master of psychoacoustic compression, relying on decades of empirical research into how our ears actually worked and combining that with complex higher mathematics and advanced computer algorithms into this brilliant piece of technology. So finally, by, let's say, 1990 or 91, he actually had the working prototype available to do this streaming service. But then they had the real problem. It wasn't a technology problem. It was a rights problem. And the recording industry just had absolutely no interest in this whatsoever. They were making such fat profits off the compact disc that they just repeatedly rebuffed all of Brandenburg's entreaties. So he was locked out of the marketplace. He was also losing to another rival format that worked in kind of a similar way, but was inferior. So essentially he was the Betamax of audio compression technology. I think I said this, but in 1995, in desperation, he just posted this encoder online for free. And then the pirates got a hold of it, and that's how most of those MP3s ended up on your hard drive.
So did Karlheinz Brandenburg end up like some of the artists in today's world, not getting any money for his stuff?
Well, then what happened? Okay, so the consumers are using this thing for free, right? But he still owns the patent rights on it. Apple and Microsoft start coming to him, and they're saying, hey, you know, we'd like to license some kind of MP3 player to play these files. And he says, sure, well, just give me a cut of every device you sell. And this is the iPod, right? So it made him hundreds of millions of dollars. At one point, he was earning a royalty for every copy of Windows XP that shipped. So the sort of irony of his story ultimately is he became fabulously wealthy off intellectual property licensing, but that was only possible through the greatest wave of copyright infringement that the world had ever seen.
Wow. So somebody got rich in this. Stephen,
yeah, he did, and so did actually Apple, it should be said. Remember, in 2000, they were a third-tier niche technology player that nobody really took seriously. At the beginning of this millennium, Microsoft was 33 times larger by market capitalization than Apple was. And it was only by the invention of the iPod, which kind of acted as like a money launderer for these illegal spoils of Napster, that they were able to gain the power that they have today.
And if anybody's wondering about the market capitalization of Apple, I looked this up just the other day, $750 billion,
yeah,
roughly.
Now the largest publicly traded company on the planet.
It's an amazing number. The book is called How Music Got Free. Stephen Witt is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. I get the sense that Karlheinz Brandenburg and a lot of his fellow researchers were working in theory that was getting really out ahead of their computers.
I'm saying, excuse you, can you say the question again?
That they were working in ways that their computers really couldn't handle.
Oh, right. So this is one of the reasons that the MP3 had a hard time catching up at first. Their algorithms were so sophisticated, and remember, this is the 1980s we're talking about, that the computer processing power wasn't even there. To play back an MP3 until about 1994 or so, no home computer could even do it in real time. That's how much computing power it took. Of course, 20 years later, because computer processing power advances so quickly, this is kind of a joke now. Your computer can run it in the background and not even worry about it. But at the dawn of the digital era, this was a huge problem for them.
The point, again, is that MP3 files take up, what, like a tenth of the space of a comparable WAV file, for example, or CDA
file?
That's right. All right, so much, much less space. So what happened with the original MP3, though, is it ended up in a standards war. I mean, you talked about the Betamax losing out to VHS, even though Betamax was the superior format for visuals. But this is also like the railroad gauges settling on the distance between the rails and AC versus DC power. And MP3 did not do well in that phase.
There was a rival technology developed by a rival group, also including scientists from Germany, that was called the MP2. Now, it sounds like the MP3 is going to be the successor to the MP2, but actually that's not true. They were rival technologies developed in parallel by competing groups, and the competition between them was vicious. This is something I go into a lot in the book. So for all of the early industrial applications of these kind of psychoacoustic compressors, the MP2 won all the competitions. They ended up having the earliest audio layer on DVD, interactive CD, digital radio, all this stuff. And the MP3 was really locked out of the market. Now, in the end, that benefited them, because it was the end user, the pirates, who really decided who was going to win this war. And they favored the superior audio quality of the MP3 because they were kind of audio quality snobs in a way that the standards committees were not.
Interesting. So things got determined by the market, but in this case, it was a black market.
Yeah, things got determined by the black. It wasn't even really a market because they weren't selling anything. Things got determined by sort of the users who were getting this stuff for free.
Now, there's a great anecdote in the book where you point out that Karlheinz Brandenburg, the father of the MP3, was told by someone, "You've killed the music industry." How did he react to that?
Now, Ricky Adar told him that. And Ricky Adar, in 1995, was actually trying to build another music streaming service very similar to what Dieter Seitzer had proposed in 1982. But this time, the technology was there. I think Adar saw that the rights holders at the music labels were never going to give this stuff up, but that there was a looming kind of ability in the home PC market to just distribute it without their authorization. Now, Brandenburg, maybe he sort of misjudged the average person. Brandenburg's a very moral, very upstanding, and very decent and honest person. And, of course, this is a huge mistake on his part because he assumes everyone else is going to be that way, and they're not. So his assumption that everyone would behave like he does was not grounded in reality.
Indeed not. The book is called How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. Stephen Witt is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can take part in the conversation. Go on, tell us how many albums you've downloaded over the years. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. We'll talk about your 8 tracks, too. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So let's shift the scene back to Patient Zero of Piracy.
Sure.
Del Glover, we've talked about already. Now, the Polygram CD Manufacturing Center in North Carolina, where he worked, upon first description, sounds like a military installation.
Yeah, it had quite good security. They were very concerned with these discs getting out of the plant. And when Polygram sold the plant to Universal in 98, security got even tighter. So from that point forward, what happened is as you left the plant, you would go through what was essentially like a security turnstile, similar to what's set up at customs way stations at an airport. You'd swipe your employee identification pin as you were leaving the compact disc area, and if you got the green light, which maybe that happened 4 out of 5 times, you got to go through the turnstile. But randomly, 1 out of 5, you get the red light, and they take you over to a little area, and they take a metal detecting wand, and they'd wave it up and down your body, searching for that thin aluminum core that was the plating in the compact disc.
And the wand could actually sense that?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. They couldn't use an airport-style, walkthrough because that wouldn't sense the aluminum. But this very special wand that they had could, okay? As long as they had it close enough to your body. Now, if they found that disc on you, you were fired immediately, and they pressed charges for embezzlement. But nevertheless, Glover and his smuggling confederates found a way to get the discs out. What they'd realized by watching thousands and thousands of times people getting wanded was that it would always hit certain articles of their clothing and go off. In particular, in this small town, North Carolina, it would hit these big belt buckles that everybody wore. The wand would set off on the belt buckle, but they never made you take it off. So what Dell realized, and all his friends realized, is they kind of wrapped the discs in a latex glove inside the facility and then stuffed it behind their belt buckles and walked out through the plant. Even if they got flagged by the security system, they could still get the discs out. And in this way, they got about 2,000 albums out over the course of 7 years, including, as I say, all of the major hits of that period. Jay-Z, Kanye West, Eminem. They had a real focus on rap. These leakers and these pirates, they loved rap. And eventually they branched out into everything. Taylor Swift, Justin Bieber, Rick Ross, all that stuff, Lady Gaga, all of it came from this one plant that was posted online and then shared millions and sometimes tens of millions of times.
We're not giving Del Glover enough credit for what he was able to do. I mean, he was not quite perhaps in league with Karlheinz Brandenburg, but really good with computers. I mean, this is a guy who bought his first computer from Sears, I think, when he was in his teens, right?
Yeah, in 1989. This was not a time in small town, working class North Carolina that people were very interested in computers. As I say in the book, the average resident of Shelby was more likely to own a hunting rifle than a PC. But he had always had a fascination with technology. He loves cars. He loves compact disc players. He loves taking things apart and putting them back together. He's a tinkerer. And so from a very early age, he had this real fascination with computers. And he was part of maybe the first public wave of the Internet, people getting online in 94 and 95 off services like CompuServe and AOL Online, or America Online. So he was really one of these early guys who was in bulletin board systems, on Internet relay chat channels, and on the public Internet, sort of bringing the public mentality to what had previously been a kind of closed academic software.
So, you know, Dell sounds like such an upstanding guy, as you describe him in the book. What led him over to going into actually taking things out of the plant where he knew he could get fired, if not prosecuted as well?
The dark side of smuggling. Yeah, he was a really hard worker, but it wasn't enough. He wanted more money. So, interestingly, Rabid Neurosis, the leaking group that he was a part of that infiltrated the music industry's supply chain, they actually had their own ethos. And their ethos was that the leaks were not to be sold. They were to be shared among this closed community of leakers. And it wasn't just music. They had guys in other media supply chains as well. They had people cracking video games. They had people leaking Oscar screeners from the Academy. They had people going inside movie theaters and, you know, with a camcorder and bootlegging movies. And they had people getting television and all their forms of media. Dell did not obey this ethos. He saw that those other media leaks were valuable. He built a couple of towers of DVD duplicators, started downloading the early leaks from these sites, and then burning them to compact or disc or later to a DVD. Then he started selling that bootleg material out of the trunk of his car. There was huge demand for this stuff because he was beating the video stores and even the other bootleggers by days and weeks. Okay? So from there, his operation grew very elaborate. He started deputizing barbers and local barber shops to sell the material for him. He'd show up with a spindle of bootleg DVDs, maybe 100 or 200 rips, on consignment, leave it with the barber, then come back at the end of the week to collect $500 or even $1,000 in cash. His best salesmen were actually making more selling his bootleg movies than they were cutting hair.
Wow, that's an amazing story. It's one of many in the book, How Music Got Free by Stephen Witt. Let's take a call. Here's Robin in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. And what I wanted to comment on is that basically when the iPod and the MP3 players came out, they gave you so much room for data, for music, that in combination with the news groups that are still around, you can pay for a $10 subscription, and you can download unlimited amount of music, every single kind of music. When I got my iPod, and I still have the old one, with 120 GBs of data, whatever, some people have 13,855 songs on there. I'm not saying who, and they still have 57.1 GBs free for additional. And like your guest there is saying, I have some stuff that I probably will not get around to listening, but my God, it's just that the temptation is there. The capability is there. And again, as long as I'm paying for my news group subscription, I'm going to assume that, you know, some of this music is free because I'm paying for it.
Okay, all good points. Let's look
at it. But again, the combination of it all just makes it irresistible.
Right. So what your guest is referring to, now think about this, he's got 13,000 songs, or anybody has 13,000 songs on their iPod.
some random person.
Some random person, hypothetically. Now, that's going to cost you $13,000 to accumulate legally, and no one's going to do that. And so the iPod, you know, I sort of refer to this age of piracy in the 90s as a generation-wide flouting of existing body of law, right? And it's similar to the 60s generation's experimentation with illegal drugs. Well, if you want to carry that analogy a little further, then Apple, with its iPod, had invented the vaporizer, a device that was technically legal but facilitated all sorts of illegal activity. And they made a ton of money off this. I mean, they sold something like 800 800 million of these things, and it really rocketed them to sort of the first place as the largest company on the planet. You know, in just exactly the way that your guest described. Now, your guest, and I should inform him, is using something called Usenet to download his music, paying a Usenet provider to give him access to these bulletin boards where people are posting music.
Mm-hmm.
That is against the law. So just so you're aware, they may not catch you, but what you're doing is not a legal method for music distribution.
So what are the legal? I mean, you have to go through iTunes or the Microsoft download service, any one of those. I mean, because I'm sure there are some people still get confused about what's legal and not. Can you share it with your friends, for example, like you used to share cassettes of your Pink Floyd albums?
Technically, all of it is illegal. But if you're sharing a flash drive of a bunch of MP3s with your buddies, it's fine. No one's going to come after you. What they're concerned about is industrial scale pirating millions at a time. As for the way to get it legally now, that's streaming, and I think we'll handle that just after the break.
We will indeed. Thanks for setting it up. Stephen Witt's our guest. His album, whoops, his book is called How Music Got Free. It looks like an album. There's a CD on the cover. We'll talk more with Stephen and take more of your phone calls and emails about the music industry and its big changes when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the journalist Stephen Witt. He's written a book about the music industry and its gigantic changes in the last three decades. The book is called How Music Got Free, subtitled The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. He has, in fact, found the person who really is responsible more than any other individual for all of the free music out there. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the changes to the music industry. 800-838-3760 is our phone number on the exchange anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, in fact, you know, every so often I'm surprised when I go look at iTunes, for example, and discover that, and I don't know who in my household, I know it wasn't me, but somebody else there, for example, bought Mumford & Sons, but I see that the actual titles are not on the computer. They are in the cloud, and yet they still play from iTunes as if they're residing on my own computer. So it can be a little confusing to a geezer like me about where music comes from and how we pay for it.
If you think it's confusing now, just wait 1 year.
What happens then?
Everything on Apple Music is now moving away from a pay-per-use model to a subscription-based service, similar to something provided by a company called Spotify, who really pioneered this model. Last Monday, Apple announced its new service, Apple Music, which is essentially the following. You pay about $10 a month, and then you get unlimited access to 30 million songs. You don't own any of the songs. You stream them from a centralized corporate library.
So it's Dieter Seitzer's digital jukebox.
Dieter Seitzer's vision is finally here. And, you know, in 1982, they didn't have the technology. In 1994, the rights holders weren't on board. Finally, I think, all of the pieces are in place. So if we move from the vinyl to the compact disc, from the compact disc to the MP3, this is the new move. From the MP3 to the streaming service. And once you subscribe to one of these things, you'll be amazed by how convenient and fun that they are to use.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned Apple Music, and I'm glad you did, because it brings us right up to yesterday when Taylor Swift pitched a fit about the no royalties for the first few months, I guess it was, of Apple Music, and that changed instantly.
Well, I don't think she pitched a fit. I think she actually won this war quite quickly. You know, she was calm. She was polite. But she was very, very firm. Like, why are we not getting paid here? And Apple caved more or less immediately to her demands, along with not just her demands, but it actually ended up benefiting every musician. The problem for the streaming services right now is that they all lose money, and they're all paying artists a pittance in royalties. And that's not a sustainable situation. The streamers right now, it's a good service. They're fun to use, but they have to eventually extract profit from the customer, and it's not clear that they know how to do that right now.
Is this are they getting a little longer than they might have gotten before the internet age? It seems like companies get a lot longer to make a profit before their shareholders start beating them upside the head.
Yeah, I think the con- contemporary internet model is first you get the users, then you get the eyeballs, and then someday down the road you get the money. It's the Scarface model in reverse. Basically, I think, you know, you look at YouTube, which started out as a experiment in amateur uploading sort of democracy crowdsourced content in, let's say, 2005 or 2006. It no longer is that. Today, 29 of the 30 most viewed videos on YouTube are professionally produced music videos. So YouTube is kind of the world's jukebox right now. Now, it's legal, and artists get paid very small streaming revenues from it. But I think over time, it's sort of eroded a lot of value for the musicians.
So that's the big one, though, is that if nobody pays for music anymore, then nobody gets paid. And have the artists taken it the hardest, or the record companies, or who's seen the biggest loss in their income?
Everyone. It's been pain across the board, from the top, from the corporate executive suite, all the way down to the guy playing the ukulele. Everyone's been hurt. I don't think any segment of the recording industry has done well for about 15 or even 16 years. Now, what has happened is that while the recording industry has basically been cut in half, the live music market has tripled in size. And a lot of that is driven by the free availability of tons of music. Maybe you go and watch some videos on YouTube and you're like, yeah, this looks like a lot of fun. I'll go to the concert for sure. I'll go to Coachella. I can preview all these bands. I can decide whether or not I like them. And then I'll go pay $30 or $40 for a ticket. So that part of the industry is actually doing quite well. And so is the publishing, which is licensing music to advertising and movies and television.
But does that also explain why concert prices for some of the biggest names have gone so high? We're talking hundreds of dollars now for a ticket to see a Bruce Springsteen or Elton John.
For the most part, these guys are going to charge whatever the market can bear. The live music industry is just as capitalistic as the recording industry is. And guys like Irving Azoff, who runs formerly the Eagles manager, who now runs Live Nation, are going to extract that last dollar out of you. Now, you know, economists have long theorized that people sort of have a fixed entertainment budget. So if I'm not spending money on recorded music, suddenly I have all this free cash. Where is it going to go? Well, if I'm a music fan, I'm just going to put it back into live music. So maybe that's what's happening.
I want to come back to some of the concerns that people might have expressed early on. You do talk about the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA, and when it saw what was happening with people starting to steal music, what was its initial response?
Well, first they sued Napster. Then they sued the recording device makers, so these were the early MP3 players like Rio and Creative Industries. And then when that didn't work, they sued their own customers. This was a program called Project Hubcap that the RIAA ran for about 4 years, from 2003 to 2007, where they just basically picked up random users of LimeWire and Kazaa and served them with very threatening subpoenas, almost legal shakedowns, often getting, you know, end users who'd been sharing a small number of files and only had a limited understanding of the technology to pay $3,000 or $4,000 to a major recording label. Now, a few people fought these lawsuits, and they took them all the way to a jury trial. The most famous case was a woman named Jamie Thomas. And she was found liable in a civil suit. The jury decided that she owed the recording industry $222,000 for sharing 24 songs. So the damages were real. Unfortunately for the recording industry, suing your customers is not a very good business model. They won these lawsuits, but they lost the war. And the public relations nightmare that this engendered was just terrible.
And so did that woman ever pay a penny of the $223,000?
I don't know the answer to that. She appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, who ended up rejecting her petition. So she's still on the hook for it. But, you know, she's a single mother of four. I don't think she has that kind of money in her bank account.
You know, one of the issues with digital compression and the development of the MP3 in the first place was that there just weren't good networks to carry the stuff around. MP3s are of poor enough quality that I know if you run FM music services, as we do here, you try to avoid them. We run WAV files at a minimum. But over time, has it gotten to the point where you don't even really need digital compression anymore?
Oh, you still need it. If you want to stream music over your phone at the park, you're getting it. So the compact disc uses about 1.4 million bits per second, and that's about a WAV file. to store music. If you're trying to stream music at the park, you're doing it at about 96,000. So you've got to compress it by well over 90%. Remember, people still have data caps on their phones. So if they want to get music and not, you know, incur tons of data overage charges, they've got to have it compressed somehow.
All right, let's take a call. Let's talk to Jacob in Springfield. And welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Witt, the author of How Music Got Free.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I want to just point out the long-term aspects of the recording industry. Media is only about 100 years old, the recording industry, meaning, you know, records and film. And like over 100 years ago, well, since the beginning of civilization up till about 100 years ago, if we wanted to see a play, we went to vaudeville or live play performance. And that has been replaced by movies centralized in Hollywood. And it's the same way with music. Before, people went to live concerts and met the musicians, and then that was replaced 100 years ago by recording. Mm-hmm. Now, what we're doing is returning back to what it was 100 years ago. Now, now music artists make money through live performances, and they don't make any money out of recording anymore. So it's going back to the way it was for forever until the past 100 years.
Oh, so back to vaudeville in a sense. Jacob, thanks for the thoughts.
Yeah, some people have argued this, that essentially the entire recording industry was maybe just a sort of intermediary phase of technology. And maybe it's true. Remember, we now have the capability to easily distribute all of the music ever recorded to everyone at very little cost. So the question really becomes, how much do we want to lock this stuff up? Before, there were always limitations of physical distribution that would sort of limit our ability to do this. We now have the capability. It's just a question of how much of the rights we want to protect.
You know, I read a piece in The New Yorker, and it may have been yours a while back, about a bunch of people who knew audio getting together in Carnegie Hall back in the late 1900s, early 20th century.
Yeah, I did not write that.
That wasn't yours. Okay. But the point was one of the ones that you make in the book, which is that in the dark, they couldn't tell the difference between a live opera singer and Victrola playing her recording.
Right. And people's ability to distinguish between an MP3 and a compact disc is often much less than they believe. When they do double-blind sort of recording tests on this stuff, far fewer people can actually make the distinction than you might expect. Nevertheless, there are people with expert sort of hearing, professional studio engineers who've been at this for 5 or 10 years, and those guys tend to be pretty good at it. They can make the distinction. So that expertise can be gained, particularly if you have really high-quality professional audio equipment. It's just that most people aren't there. And for most people, they don't really care that much about fidelity. You know, they like to listen to, you know, Taylor Swift at the park. They want to stream music in low fidelity while they're running around on their headphones. And they care more about mobility than fidelity.
Which brings us back to the memories that some of us have of people with the little transistor radios crushed up against the sides of their heads in the 60s.
That's exactly right. Those things didn't sound very good either, but people loved them.
They did. They were playing AM radio, where we actually spend a lot of our time these days. What happened to Del Glover? Did he end up going to prison or anything? Or he probably got fired.
The FBI caught up with him in 2007. He was fired the next week. He was finally charged with conspiracy to commit copyright infringement in 2009. He was given sentencing leniency in exchange for testifying against his co-conspirators in Rapid Neurosis. In particular, the leader of the group, a shadowy online presence that he only knew as Kali, K-A-L-I, which seems to be a reference to the Hindu god of death. Now, the FBI believed that Kali was a guy named Adil Kasim, but they had a hard time proving this because on these online conspiracies, everyone sort of exists in an anonymous encrypted chat channel. You know, the way a classic crime organization works in the real world is they all know each other. It's the mafia. They're all literally in a family, or they grew up in the same neighborhood, or they all did time together. On the internet, it's the exact opposite. It's almost completely anonymous. You know, you can have these guys together in a chat channel for years in this conspiracy, and they don't know almost anything about each other. Dell, though, and Kali had talked on the phone irregularly, and this made him the government's most important witness. So when they brought the case against Kasim, he was one of the first people to testify. It wasn't a very good case, though. It wasn't very strong. And in the end, Kasim walked. He was found not guilty. Glover served 3 months in prison in exchange for, you know, a reduced sentence in exchange for his cooperation. He's now out. He works at the Freightliner Truck Manufacturing Facility in Kings Mountain, North Carolina.
It's a lot harder to steal parts from them.
It is hard to steal parts, and he's unionized, so it's a little hard to fire him.
So we haven't talked about the third thread that exists in the book. You talked about the technologists and the pirates, but also the music industry executives. There's a lot in here about Doug Morris, the North American head of the Warner Music Group at one time.
Yeah.
In general, how would you characterize the response of the music executives to the technological issues that presented themselves?
They botched it. Now, the question is, what could they have done? If they had listened to these visionaries like Seitzer and Ricky Adar, they probably would have had to take a hit on compact disc profits immediately. But in the long term, it would have been a lot better for them. But that was a hard thing to say at the time, and I don't think anyone in the industry ever really got it right. You know, it was just the salad days of the compact disc. They were selling these things in the late 90s for about $14 on average retail and manufacturing them for less than $2. So their profit margins were just immense, even after you accounted for other costs like marketing and distribution and royalties paid to the artists. These were the most profitable days the industry had ever seen. And that was unsustainable, I think. They were really extracting rents from the music consumer, both by colluding with music retailers to keep the price up, and then additionally by selling a lot of music that nobody actually wanted to hear. So if I go out and I like NSYNC and I want to buy the NSYNC album, I'm probably just interested in one or two songs, not listening to the whole album the whole way through. In the digital age, that album became unbundled, and that really cost them a lot of money too.
You think Apple Music will be the next big thing? Will it rise as high as Apple expects it to?
Look, it could. They have 800 million registered iTunes accounts. Now, who knows how many of those are dormant, but if they can get 3% of them to sign on to Apple Music, they actually become the largest streaming paid service. So they may win this just by sheer market share.
Wow. It's an amazing journey through the music business, How Music Got Free. Stephen Witt is the author of the book. If you're going to be in Seattle, you can see him tomorrow at Town Hall at 7 o'clock. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you.